Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us. Hello, and welcome to episode 17 of season 6 of This Spiritual Fix. Today we are going to be talking about sibling rivalry and how to deal with it.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation. Past life regression.
This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltse.
Hello, Anna.
Hello, Christina.
How are you?
I'm good. I just woke up from a nap, and that feels great to have a late morning nap.
I love late morning nap. I feel like that's not a common one. I feel like afternoon nap is like kind of a more common nap.
I was like up from like 6 to 10.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I did a lot of stuff. And so like from 10:30 to 11:30, I went back to bed. So yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I had the night to myself last night, and because my son and my husband went to go pick up my daughter, and I did that. Why is it, do you do this if ever you're by yourself, which I know is like a really rare thing for you, that you just like lose all sense of boundaries and you're like, yeah, I'm just going to keep staying up. You know what I mean? It's like, there's something about the freedom where you don't want to go to sleep. And like, it's like being like, whenever my husband's there, not like there for whatever reason, I do the same thing. It's like suddenly like, the cat's away, so I'm just like gonna Sunday, you know, like I could do that at any point. Like he's not stopping me from doing that and being overindulgent in that way. But
yeah. Well, I saw this Instagram quote yesterday. I think I sent it to you, and it said, when I say I want a break from my kids, I don't actually want a break from my kids. I want a break from the responsibility of them. Like I want to enjoy them without having to be the one in charge of their needs being met. And I think that maybe that's it. It's like you have the freedom of responsibility. And so the lack of responsibility lets you then unwind in other ways. And that might be ordering takeout or binging on a series. I don't know.
I think that's you hit it spot on, because I feel like that's what it is that when you're not tracking another individual, right? It's like, and that's the thing that both Luke and I do, is that like when the kids are at their grandparents' house, they like, I don't track them at all. Like I know that they're okay. You know what I mean? And it's like, we'll like occasionally call them, but they'll be gone for 4 or 5 days. And we'll just like maybe call them twice in that time period. And like, cause I just know that they're okay. And like, the ability to completely detach from the responsibility is just amazing to me. So I really loved the feedback that we got. There were just a couple of pieces of feedback that we got from re-entering, and one of them was from one of our longtime listeners. And she was like, I really respected that you guys kept your boundaries and didn't say what it was about. And I was thinking about that, because for me, I feel like we didn't have a plan and you were just like, this is what we're going to do. Like we had a plan that we might or might not talk about it, but I love the way that you came in and you were just like, we're not going to talk about this. And it was later on that week, I was like, yeah, it's really good that we didn't like triangulate our audience. Like, wouldn't that be so irresponsible of us to like triangulate our audience? People be like, I think Anna's right. Or I think Christina's right. Like, the most important thing. And one of the top things that we said in our rules with each other was that we wouldn't triangulate anybody that we knew. And that extends to our audience. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't even think of it like that. But to be honest, I was so exhausted with the topic. I didn't want to even talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like a dead horse. But anyways.
Yeah.
Speaking of today, I'm excited about today's episode because it's about siblings. So whether or not you're a parent with multiple children or not, this might be helpful for you if you have siblings. So I think this is a great episode because it can really help heal your family dynamic or at least understand your childhood better, regardless if you have children or not. But before we go into it, did you notice your son any like behaviors are different when your daughter was gone at camp this week?
It was so fascinating because I just realized how kind of self-sufficient he is, if you know what I mean, like kind of recognizing the inherent friction. It's not even friction between them necessarily. It's just that like, he's so laid back and easygoing when it's just him. It really is remarkable to me, but at the same time, like, yeah, it was interesting. I haven't really reached any conclusions about it, but I'm really excited to see what it looks like when they get home. And after this, because you told me that there was like all sorts of amazing changes that happened in your kids after you read this book, right?
Yes. Or not just because I read it, but because I actually applied what I read.
Wait, so you mean that it's not just a matter of reading a book? Like that doesn't just work. We actually have to do the things in the book.
Yeah, no. Things, well, I'll say this, that I'm a parent. I have three children. I used to say I have one stepchild and two bio kids. I'm not going to say that anymore because I learned from this book it's about you really shouldn't put people into roles, right? And I don't want to say that anymore. So I have three children and my two youngest ones bicker often, and I should say that since reading this book, the bickering has gone down substantially. And then when it does occur, it doesn't bother me and trigger me like it used to. And I'll explain all that why, but it's no longer a stress for me when they argue like it used to be. So anyways, awesome. We'll get into all that.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. So one of the things that is kind of crucial to a foundational understanding of this is like to understand the dynamics that are oftentimes really fundamental to what we know about having siblings in particular. Your husband sent us a YouTube about the divine masculine. And it was really interesting because one of the things that they said in the beginning of that was like so much coming into the collective unconscious is mother wound, father wound, sister wound, brother wound. And I was like, shit, we haven't done sister wound and sister wound and brother wound. I was like, we haven't done that. But I feel like birth order is one of those things that can really lend itself to an understanding of how that might show up. Obviously, we're not in this circumstance calling it a wound. We're kind of figuring out other different and interesting ways to not make it a wound, right? To make sibling dynamics not turn into a wound. So here are some of the traits of all of the different types of child. So there's a firstborn, for everybody who's not aware of birth order, there's firstborn, middle child, youngest, and middle child has a tendency to be anybody, even if you have more than three brothers and sisters, and then only child. So there's like four main dynamics that we can say as to traits that are associated with being the oldest, the middle, the youngest, and an only child. So the oldest child is, think of if you've ever seen Encanto, it's the I'm the strong one, I'm the big one, you know, like the under pressure song. That is the essence of the firstborn child. They are a go-getter. They're responsible. They are the role model. They are determined. They're a rule follower because they have been told, they have basically had to always established the rules and worked really, really hard to establish them as well as to establish trust. And so they are almost always going to be following the rules. I would say that they resonate very strongly in the injustice wound, probably hard worker, cautious, bossy. The first child is always that one who is taking the full responsibility. They also have a lot of karmic attachment energetically because of the fact that they are oftentimes the one who has to transition their parents into becoming parents. And that can be a really, really karmically difficult position to be in. And what you may find is that the oldest child may actually opt out of taking care of elderly parents because they may have felt that they had to be a secondary parent, or they may have had to feel like they've already had a very big role in their parents' lives already, and they don't want to have to transition them. I've seen that consistently, that eldest children don't necessarily want to take care of the elder and aging parents. Middle children tends to stand out because of they are usually agreeable and they're open to new experiences. Their key traits are they're adaptable. They're usually a social butterfly. They're dreamers. They're generous and creative and rebellious and competitive, funny, and also very good at negotiating most of the time is kind of a general consensus for middle children. It's interesting because if there's more than one middle child, I have often seen in my observations that that there will be some repeating patterns, like perhaps the second oldest child will be more kind of carefree and maybe very, very creative and different. Whereas the third oldest child, if they're still a middle child, will maybe take on some more characteristics of the eldest. But you may have different dynamics in your family. The youngest child is often a risk taker. They're outgoing, they're independent, they're persistent, fun-loving, easygoing, free-spirited, and spoiled. Oftentimes they are considered the baby and kept the baby of the family, and therefore have a very, very different dynamic going on because they can break all the rules because the parents have been broken in and they're kind of like trying on an old worn out shoe. They have a lot of freedom to do what they want. One of the things about youngest children is that though they have a tendency to be more what's considered irresponsible. Funnily, I grew up in a family with all eldest children, and I was the only youngest child. And that dynamic got pointed out all the time because all the eldest children, like my sister and my stepmother and my father were all eldest children. And so they were all like super responsible, and they always singled me out as the only youngest child so that I couldn't understand different dynamics. And now my daughter is the only eldest child, and me and my husband and my son are all youngest children. So we have a flip of that dynamic.
Oh, wow.
And then finally, only children, which I just want to mention here, is only children have a tendency to be very mature because they didn't necessarily have a lot of child playmates that happen naturally at home all the time. Loyal, they're very independent, oftentimes very confident and a leader, but they also tend to be very cautious and sensitive. So I think that this is probably... these dynamics are very simplified in the sense that, like, I think that things change a lot if you add any of the ACEs into this or any like extenuating circumstances. Like my husband's family has a dynamic where there's one person who's special abilities or special needs that's in the middle of that mix. So it changes that dynamic a lot because naturally the parent's attention changes and puts emphasis on wherever that special needs child is within the birth order, and birth order kind of gets thrown out the window a little bit. And also when I say ACEs, as in like, if there's any trauma or loss of a parent or anything along those lines, it's like a very big event that happens in a family's life. Like those can obviously change sibling rivalries as well as any sibling dynamics. But this is kind of the general idea of all other things being normal in very heavy quotes.
Normal in quotes. All right. Well, I'm going to tell you the book I read. It's called Siblings Without Rivalry, How to Help Your Children Live Together So You Can Too by Adele Faber and Elaine Mazlish. And I actually bought this book for me and my family. I didn't have the intention of making a podcast episode about it, but because it was so good, I was like, okay, we're going to make a whole podcast episode about this book. So there's that. So I'm going to go through paraphrasing to the best of my knowledge the things that I got out of this book, but I want to preface it with saying it's a really, really good book. I recommend actually reading it. I listen to it on audio. You can purchase it, but there are so many stories, and that's what I really loved about it, is that this therapist put on a workshop, and so each chapter has like four or five stories of people in these workshops giving their own story about their childhood or the kid's childhood. And it's so relatable and it's really well done. So Unfortunately, I can't give you all the stories from the podcast, you know, but the book has all that in there. Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about is the importance of sibling relationships. So I read this once, and I don't know if there's any truth to it. I don't know where I read it, but that once a parent has a second child, 70% of its rearing is coming from the sibling above it. So children have an incredible impact. Yeah, I've read that. I don't know how they could ever scientifically, you know, create that. But I know that that is really, really, your sibling role has so much to do with how you turn out. And another thing that's really interesting is there was this book, I think it was called Freakonomics, or maybe it was Outliers. And they said one of the greatest predictors of a child's future success and like mental health had nothing to do with how many books were in their house or if they went to private school or this or that. The greatest identifier for their success had to do with level of education of the mother at the birth of their firstborn child, which is to say, if I had a child in high school and then I went on to have my master's and doctorate and then I had a child after I had my doctorate, that child would still behave as if I was in the demographic as a high school mom. Okay. And then if I waited to have all my kids when I had a doctorate, those kids are going to be quote unquote more successful and happier than the high school parent. Okay. Of course there are outliers. And of course, you know, this is not a destined thing, but basically education level of the mother is the greatest predictor of future success. And it's by the birth of the firstborn child. It is no consequence if you give birth and then get a better education and then give birth again. And that shows me, I believe, that it's the influence of the sibling and the family dynamic that continue on, right? You're perpetuating that cycle regardless if you improve your education then.
What's the point of doing anything in self-improvement if it doesn't? No, sorry.
I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes. But yeah, it's very fascinating, don't you think?
I think that's completely fascinating. It's funny. I know that for me, I was very immature when I had my first child, like even though I was in my 30s. And I'm like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't, I guess. Okay, I'm not going to attribute it to shadow work. I'm just going to attribute it to exactly what the study says, which is what is my level of education, my level of actual education. But that is mind blowing. Wow.
Yeah, well, they can't study self-help, right? When they're doing these studies, they can only ask people to write down like what's your highest level of education or what year did you graduate? So anyways, okay, that was not in the book. But now going back to the book, she talks a lot about things which made me examine my beliefs about what sibling behavior, quote unquote, should look like. So before I read this book, to give you a sense, I grew up in a family of four siblings. We had a dying mother in my childhood, so a lot of stress with that. Basically a single father on an emotional level, an angry dying mother on another level. And then she did die when children were ages 5, 8, 11, and 15. Okay. So we did not get along. There was a lot of physical violence, emotional violence, really bad stuff in my house growing up. Like when I was telling a story to my husband about my childhood and one of my brothers threw knives at me and pushed me out of a moving car. And like, there was like and my children were just shocked. And like, there was biting. And I mean, there was physical blood fights in my home. And I always thought that when I had my own family, they were going to get along, that I was going to find some magical recipe, or because I was healthy and I wasn't dying, that I would have happy children who got along all the time. So I had this like fantasy world of children who get along all the time. So when my children argue, it was really triggering for me because I'm like, oh, fuck, like this is going to end up like my childhood where, by the way, we all get along now as adults. And a lot of we chat constantly. We see each other every year. Like we're all get along now, but we did have a rough interactions as kids. So when my kids argue, it would trigger me into thinking, oh God, they're going to go all the way to high school, hating each other and blood drawn and but that's not the case. So one of the main things that I got from this was examining what sibling behavior looks like and to recognize that it's normal not to like who you live with all the time. That is normal. And I had this fantasy of siblings getting along. And what the author says that sibling rivalry is very helpful in the sense that it teaches conflict management, resolution management, and also it just teaches your kid the harsh reality that in life, you are going to have to be around people you don't like. You might get assigned a roommate in college that you don't like. You might have to work in a group project for high school with someone you don't like. You might not like your boss. You might not like your neighbor. There's infinite opportunities in life to have to be working side by side with someone you don't like. And your children might not like each other. And guess what? That's okay. They don't have to like each other. They do need to learn how to work together. And so that was really brought me so much peace to realize there are times they don't like each other and that's okay. It's okay for them not to like each other all the time, right? I don't even like my husband all the time, right?
Yep.
All right. Another thing the book taught me was to examine my beliefs about seeing my children as a unit versus as individuals. So like I said before, I would see them as quote unquote my children. Like I would lump them in and think, well, my kids need to behave like this and my kids need to behave like that, instead of being like, I have a child who is like this and needs this, and I have a child like that who needs that. And I know that sounds really silly and juvenile that I wouldn't recognize that my children are individual beings, but for some reason, like, I just lump them together constantly in my mind, and they're not. They're autonomous, totally different people, totally different astrological charts, total different needs, you know?
Yes.
So there's that. The other one is to examine the roles and dynamics you played in your own family and what roles and dynamics you are enforcing consciously or unconsciously, intentionally or unintentionally on your child. So for example, this made me reflect on my own life and the roles that I was given. I was given, like, in a lot of ways, the golden child, because I was the second born daughter. My mother was the second born daughter. So she would always take my side in arguments. I was very honest and I would admit when I did something wrong. So I got the reputation of being the honest child, but I used it to my advantage. So I would actually lie and the parents would still believe me because I had created this role of the honest child, and my siblings really resented me a lot. And my brother, even this day, we got a little bickering argument the other day and he called me dad's favorite. And I was like, it's, you know, there's that thing. And I played it up to my advantage to wield more power in the family. And yet it bit me in the ass because it made my siblings resentful of me. And we'll get more into roles later, but, you know, recognizing how children get put into roles or they exploit roles. And I want to hear about yours because I know you were the quote unquote black sheep, and we'll get into that when we get into the roles. But anyways, so then the book, beyond like self-reflection and examination, the book goes into what we can do to help encourage children to get along better and to manage their own arguments and things like that. The author talks about acknowledgement, which is basically recognizing that brothers and sisters need to have their feelings about each other acknowledged with words that identify the feeling or wishes. Sometimes it can be symbolic with pictures. Like, for example, let's say that they're arguing. You could say, and they come to you about an argument, and you could say, like, give them both paper and say, I want you to draw the problem. You know, have them both draw a problem and draw a solution. And I'm going to give you some practical examples from the book. Instead of dismissing negative feelings about a sibling, like let's say the child says, you're always with the baby. Instead of saying, no, I'm not. I just read to you, or I spent all this time with you, or when you were a baby, I spent that much time with you. You can focus more on their feelings and not bring the other child into it and say, oh, you want more time with mommy. You know, like taking the sibling thing out of it and focusing on what are the child's like secret needs behind their complaint about the sibling. Another one is, you know, mom, Joey said I sound like a moron, and you respond by saying, oh, just ignore him, or that's not true. You acknowledge their feelings and say, being called a moron can make you feel mad and hurt, can't it? You know, like acknowledging whatever they're experiencing. This is one in my house. One would be, oh, she coughed and didn't cover her mouth and her germs got on my food. And instead of saying big deal or you'll be fine, you say, do you feel like he did that just to irritate you? Like you address the actual problem. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Are we going to get to the point where there's the problem that I struggle with is the consequence? It's funny because actually, can I also mention that this sounds so much like The Happiest Toddler on the Block? Did you ever read The Happiest Toddler ones?
No.
That may have been like a couple years after for you. But like one of the things about The Happiest Toddler on the Block is that you're supposed to match their energy and be incredibly like it's they call it like the Neanderthal talk. Whereas if a kid's having a tantrum, like instead of being like, it's okay, honey, and trying to calm them down because they're not in their prefrontal cortex at all. If they're just like, I want the binky or I want the blah, blah, blah. You're supposed to match the energy and say very similar things and just totally acknowledge what it is that they have and what
exactly.
It is that they are. And it's funny that that's the advice then. And that's still the advice, right? Is that people
right.
just want to know that they're heard is like such a huge part of it.
Such a huge part. And that all, and she talks about how that'll dissipate a lot of it. And I've noticed that too. It dissipates a lot of the energy, just acknowledgement. But the thing is when they're asking for the binky, you have no emotional attachment to the binky. So you can do it very easily. When they're complaining about the sibling who you also love, it can make you distracted, right?
That's it. And that's where I'm just like, what about the consequence? Like, that's what my son complains about is that we acknowledge how he feels, but there's no consequence for his sister.
Well, we're going to get to that part, which
okay.
is really cool.
Okay.
We're going to get
to
the consequences. We're going to get to the consequences, which is awesome, which I love.
Okay.
Okay. Another thing she talks about is give children in fantasy what they don't have in reality by expressing what they want. So for example, they're saying, send the baby back to the hospital. I don't want them. And then instead of saying, you don't mean that. This is your baby brother. This is your best friend. You say, oh, it sounds like you don't want the baby here. Sometimes you wish he'd go away. Sometimes you wish you'd have mommy all to yourself. So like you acknowledge the feeling and then you can also give them the fantasy of like, this is the thing that you'd want. It's really hard. You know, it's really hard to have the baby here for you. It sounds like you really want more time with mommy or whatever the fantasy is, right? She talks about helping the children channel their hostile feelings into symbolic or creative outlets. We've heard all that. Like, you know, you give them markers to draw the picture or a punching bag, but they talk about writing a letter or show me on this doll how you feel or whatever, things like that. And then you want to stop hurtful behavior. Like you do want to have the child be free to express how they feel. Because again, it's okay for them not to like their sibling all the time. It's okay for them to want the baby to go back to the hospital. That's okay. They're allowed to feel what they feel, right? But you can't allow for hurtful behavior. So in our house, that's name calling or any violence. Luckily, my kids aren't violent. But there are homes where the kids do push or punch or whatever. So you stop hurtful feelings by show that angry feelings can be discharged safely. You refrain from attacking the attacker by showing better ways of expressing anger. You lead by example. So let's say your child says, he stole my brownie. He's a dirty thief. You don't say, that's a terrible thing to call your brother. You would say, you sound furious, but I expect you to confront your brother about what he's done without name calling. All right. Or that stupid idiot ate all the cookies. And then instead of saying, well, you've done the same to him in the past, you say, okay, I understand that let's talk about what happened without calling names. Instead of name calling, tell them how you feel or what you want. So really taking away the name calling stuff. And we'll get into consequences later. That's so funny that your kids ask for consequences. But anyways.
They really do. They really do. But I think it's because we've been kind of, we've been implementing a lot of consequences recently, and it's really hard for me, especially when everyone's like arguing about the truth, right? You know, it's like one person's like, well, this person did this and this person did this. And we often also get caught up in the whole, but it was an accident. And so now we've pulled in this idea of being careless, which then is a very slippery slope because, you know, like if you are like whipping something around the room and you carelessly hit the dog or you hit like a person, they can be like, well, it was an accident. It's like, yes, but being careless is actually a consideration. It's not about people pleasing. It's not about not expressing yourself. Oh my God. Anyway, I'm going to stop. I'm going to let you talk. You're going to solve all my problems with this, Anna, right?
Yes. Hopefully. So, okay, the next thing she talks about is comparison. Like, comparison is the worst thing you can do with your kids. And this was the major wake-up call that I had, is that I do compare my children often, like, in ways I thought were good, but they're not. It's not good to compare at all. And comparison is the thief of joy. And I just want to read a little blurb from the Desiderata, if you remember that one. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain or bitter, for always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself, right? Like, there's always someone who's better at you than something, and there's always someone who's worse at you than something, and you're going to become vain or bitter if you compare yourself. Well, comparing children to each other is like one of the worst things that you could possibly do. And I have so many experiences in my childhood of how I was used as the comparison role model against my siblings' behavior, and how that really rooted a lot of resentment. Really, really bad stuff. So you want to resist the urge to compare at all costs. Instead of comparing one child to another, speak to the child only about the behavior that pleases or displeases you. And you talk about what you see and what needs to be done. Like, and I'm going to give you examples because it's kind of confusing, but I used to think that favorable comparison was good, and it's like not, it's not good at all. So instead of saying to the older child, "You're a big boy now. Wow, you're so organized. You don't leave all your things lying around like the baby who's so messy," right? You'd say, "Hey, I see you picked up your blocks, your truck, and even put away your puzzle pieces. Great job." You know, you don't need to compare to the other child. Or if you say, "I wish your brother had your study habits. He can't concentrate for more than a minute." Just say, "Wow, you've done a great job studying for the last hour." You know, things like that. Don't compare.
But what happens if they compare anyway? So we've gotten to the point where I have to only praise my children for things that they're good at when I'm completely alone with them. And so naturally compare all the time. Like, all the time.
Okay, give me an example and I'll see if I can apply what she's saying.
So my son has traditionally found it a lot easier to concentrate. I'll just use that as the example. And so he naturally, because it's easier for him to concentrate, he shows more aptitude and interest in math. And so I'll be like, so if we say like, "Hey, son, you're really good at math," like, or not, "You're really good at math," we'll say something that's not judgmental, like us trying to say this is good or bad. Like, that's a really wonderful skill of, or again, I'm not giving you a good example.
Okay. Let's say he does a math equation and you're like, "Great work."
Yes, exactly. And because we're always trying to praise the effort and not the skill or talent. That's something that I learned a long time ago, right? Was like, the most successful children are the ones who you don't actually say, "Look at you being so talented." You're entirely need to praise the fact that they are the effort and work that went into it, because that's how you actually gain the most confidence, because they recognize that if they can apply that hard work and effort anywhere, then they can learn anything, as opposed to thinking that talent is inherent or skill is inherent and therefore like they just have it or they don't.
Well, instead of talking about the math, you can just say, "Wow, you worked really hard on that. Great job." She would say, which I'm going to get to later, you don't need to make things equal. You should not make things equal. If your son is deserving of praise in that moment, you give him praise. You obviously wouldn't say, "Oh, you're so good at math and your sister sucks."
No, of course not.
No, I know, I'm kidding. But if he's deserving of praise, then you would give it to him in that moment. That's what she says.
Okay.
She talks about, obviously, avoid unfavorable comparisons. Like, "That's disgusting. Even the baby doesn't spill all over himself." You would say, "Hey, there's a little milk dripping from your shirt," right? Like, you just, favorably or unfavorably, you don't compare. They might do it on their own. So I talked a little bit about my parents used to compare me as like the high academic achiever and the honest child, right? And the responsible one, and that fucked up things. I remember once, it doesn't even have to be parents. Like, I remember once a family friend of ours, we were at an art gallery opening and my back was turned and she didn't see me. And she comes up and hugs my sister and she says, "How's the prettiest fiddler daughter?" And I'm like right there. And I was like, "What the fuck?" And so I had it in my head I had it in my head forever that my sister was the pretty one, but I was the smart one. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, comparison is really, really not good. But anyways, what about you?
Well, I was this is why I've been so messed up with my son, because my son has a natural propensity for, is naturally talented at science and math and things like that. And he's just kind of finding it easier because he's constant, it's easier for him to concentrate or whatever. My daughter has so many skills, but this was kind of the thing that I experienced when I was younger, is that like I was 100% the troublemaker. Like I was, but my sister kind of, because as a result of all the things that had gone on for us when we were younger, she like kind of was more invisible, as she would use for her words. Like she was just like, she just kind of disappeared. Like anytime there was a conflict, she was flight, right? She just like hid. You know, whereas I would always go out and actually fight, or I would actually be out in the front. So I was always considered the troublemaker. I was also the one that was highly triggering to almost everybody. And that was one aspect of it. But the other thing that was considered, and the thing that I remember the most clearly, was that I was incredibly precocious, in the sense that I was, I guess, considered highly intelligent for that age. And so I was constantly being praised for how intelligent I was and how good I was at math and how good I was at all these different things. And my sister did not get any of that, right? Like she didn't get that experience. In fact, she got the incredibly negative experience of people saying, like, even people in places of trust, like telling her just awful, awful things about her and her experience and like her intelligence. And so I was always considered the more intelligent one. I was always the problematic one, but I was always considered the more intelligent one and given more effort to be able to do that and given more skills and resources as a result of being more intelligent in the view of everybody else. And so, you know, it was really hard because, you know, I suspect that my sister, given different circumstances, would have also qualified and been gifted and things like that. But she took the death of our mother in a completely different way than I did. And she protected me so much in those really, really young formative days that so much of her attention and capacity probably got pulled for that. And so she was never given those opportunities to show how incredibly intelligent she is. And for me, I was given those. So to put it in the end, it's like, I've always struggled with this because I know how much it harmed my sister to be considered not the intelligent one. And so I've struggled with my children when it feels like they have different skills and intelligences. And like, how do you support one while the other one feels like they need to, especially if it's not as easy to support my one child's form of intelligence, which is much more psychic abilities and different things like that. Like, you know, very ephemeral skills, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the author's not here to talk, but my guess is she'd say that you would praise each child without putting them into roles.
And I think she'd say to really focus on each child's unique needs, which I'm going to get to in a minute, but say, you know, establish that in this family, we don't compare ourselves to each other, you know, and hone in on each child's special and unique needs and talents.
Okay. Okay.
I think that's what she'd say.
And that's where I have been doing that a lot, right? Is that there's so much, I think that one of the things that we overestimate is our children's developmental milestones that happen as they grow up. That's one thing I've really learned, right? Is that like, I sometimes assume that my children have the same ability that I do at my age now. And it's like very hard to develop that beginner's mind. And of like what it was like to actually have that understanding. And so my daughter, for instance, is fantastic at visual math. She's so good at it, like fractions and geometry and just like all of those aspects of math. She's so good at, but she forgets that that's also math. Right. And so she's like, I'm not good at math. And it's like, no, like all or nothing thinking in this case, just because this part of math might be hard for you, this other part you're actually really, really good at, and it still qualifies as math.
Yeah. But see, then you're making comparison. And on some level, she's probably noticing that you're holding back from praising your son to protect her, which might make her then think that something's wrong with her.
Right. Good point.
Okay. All right. So another thing she talks about in the book is equal is less. Don't treat your children equally. This was kind of like really hard for me to understand because my dad has always been, yeah, he did the roles and the comparison, but he's always tried to treat us all equally, like even with the grandchildren. If it's one of the grandchildren's birthday and he posts a birthday photo of them on Facebook, he then will go and post a photo of every other grandchild at some point during the week to like make it fair. Like he will never post one grandchild without also posting all the others.
I this is the, I just saw a video about this on social media where there was an 11-year-old girl. She was the eldest, and she had to she it was her birthday, and she was blowing out her candles, and the mother, like the youngest one, was trying to blow out the candles too. So the mother relit the candle and let everybody blow out the candle on the 11-year-old's birthday. And of course everybody was reacting and just being like, this is utterly ridiculous that this supposed equal treatment is a good idea. Whereas you can just see the girl in the video, her face, it just keeps falling with every single one of her siblings who gets to blow a candle out on her birthday.
Yeah, and all that saliva. Anyways, clearly the coughing thing on the food was in my house.
Yeah.
All right. So she talks about loving equally is to be loved less. You want to love uniquely for one's own special self. You want to love someone as they are, and the children don't need to be treated equally. They need to be treated uniquely. So each child has unique needs. For example, like a great example she used, which is something I have done, is let's say, for example, my eldest child is all out of socks and my youngest child has way too many. And then I go to the store to buy my eldest one socks and I've had the thought, I'm going to come home empty-handed for the younger one who has socks already. And then I'd just like buy him a t-shirt or something to like make it up. Like I don't have to do that. Why am I spending more money on a church t-shirt he doesn't need to make it quote unquote equal or fair? So like not doing that. And then if he was to say, well, where didn't I get anything? I would just say, you have plenty of socks. Let's go count your socks. Do you think you don't have enough socks? Let's go count them. You know? So
Yeah.
she gives a couple of different guidelines. Instead of giving equal time, give according to need. So, for example, the child says, you gave him more than me. Instead of saying, I did not, I gave you each four. And the child says, but his are bigger. You'd say, oh, are you still hungry? Like, don't even bring the other child into the situation. This is a relationship between you and that kid about the food that you've given. And you say, oh, are you still hungry? Would you like me to make you another pancake? And they might not even want the other pancake. They just want it to be fair. So you bring it back to what are their actual needs, not the
Okay.
equality.
Oh, I like that one a lot. I feel like that feels really good. Because you're not even addressing it, because that's what we always say about my daughter, is that you always have to be the water and not the rock, because she's the rock, right? And so if you become the rock with my daughter, meaning like if you try and actually go head to head with her, it's just you're just going to butt heads. You always have to be the water, which me and I feel like that is a perfect explanation of being the water, right? Where you're just like, and let's just divert around this and go directly to needs. That's
Right.
awesome.
Just, yeah, as much as possible, keep the other child out of the conversation always with your other kid. Right. So, oh, here's another example. Instead of claiming equal love, show that they're loved uniquely. The kid says, who do you love the best? Like my dad used to say, you see my fingers? Which finger do you think I love? He always would say, which finger do you think I love more? If you chopped off this finger, would it hurt less than this one? And then me, my smart ass would say, well, actually, your thumb is the most important one, you know, because it separates us
And
from whatever, you know.
since he had four kids, you can be like, you guys are the fingers. He's the
Yeah, he would
thumb.
probably, he'd probably end up saying that. But anyways, so I've done it too. I'm like, oh, I love you all the same. Well, now, according to the book, you would say, each one of you is special to me. You are my only Christina. There's not another like you. No one has your thoughts, your feelings, your smile. I'm so glad you're my daughter, Christina. There is no other Christina in this world like you. So you really hone in on their uniqueness versus, yeah, I love you all the same, right? And then she talks about how equal time can feel like less. Give time in terms of needs. Let's say, for example, mommy, you're paying too much attention to so-and-so, or mommy, I want you too. And then you say to that child that you're paying attention to, hey, I got to go. I got to spend time with Joey also. And then that child says, no, fair. Joey always gets what he wants. Instead, you would say, you know what? You're right. I have been spending a lot of time with your sibling. Their birthday party is really important, and that's what we're discussing. It requires my full attention. I know it's hard to wait, and I know you want my full attention. Instead of saying, not your turn, that's what I'll say. You should do that. Delete. When I'm finished, I want to hear what you have on your mind. Okay? And then you're giving the idea that when that child has needs, you will be there for them too, right? Yeah. You want to add anything to that or no?
No, I think that sounds good. We struggle a lot with the fact that my kids always want to talk to us whenever we start talking to each other, because we're oftentimes always doing activities. And when my husband and I come together, we want to talk to each other to like coordinate or whatever. Like out of everything that we do all day, we don't get that much time to talk to each other. But it's like the one time my kids hone in to be like, oh, they're available to talk because they're talking to each other. And so we struggle with that one a lot, but not necessarily in this context of spending time with one kid versus another. It's spending time with each other versus spending time with them.
Right. So maybe in that situation, you'd say, you know, mommy's talking to daddy right now and I want to give him my full attention. Why don't you go into your room and write a list of all the things you want to talk to me about? When I'm done, I want to listen, or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Something. All right. Now we're going to talk about roles. So you have different roles in families. Like people get put in different roles. Like I was talking about how my sister was the pretty daughter. I was the smart daughter. My brother was the troublemaker. And then the fourth, the baby, we called him the shadow because he was always behind my father. Like cause my dad basically raised him fully without my mom. So we used to call him the shadow, that he was just like a micro version of my own dad, because he like learned how to do plumbing when he was six and all sorts of hilarious things. Wow. Yeah. So we do put kids into roles. Some common roles that you've heard of are probably the black sheep, the golden child, and the glass child. The glass child is a little bit less known, but basically the glass child is when there is a family where one of the children has a disability, the other child becomes the quote unquote healthier child becomes the glass child, meaning that they are often overlooked because the special needs child requires so much more attention and time, or they're held to an impossible standard of like, you're the healthy one, you're the good one, you don't need us, you know, you can't be misbehave because you're the good kid, stuff like that. We should never put any child into a role, like no role. No one should lock a child into a role, not the parents, not the child themselves, and not the brothers or sisters. And even if they have real disabilities, they should not be locked into roles. Their unique needs should still be addressed, and their unique abilities should still be addressed, right?
Can I just say how much I feel like this applies? I like talk to my clients about this in an adult context as well. So not only is it like toddler advice goes to grown kids, but I feel like growing kids also goes to an adult, which is that so often the roles serve a purpose for a very long time. And then they're so detrimental when we've outgrown them as adults and we haven't gotten rid of them. Right. You know, like I'm this person, I'm that person. I can't write blah, 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 blah. Or I can write.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting if you think about your parents, what their sibling order was and what roles they were put into. Like, for example, my mother was the second daughter and her big sister was a real bully. And she would, when my sister would quote unquote bully me, my mom would take me aside and like totally empathize with me and then tell me all the horrible things her sister used to do to her. And how her sister once like knocked out her teeth and like hit her over the head with an iron. Like I know all these stories about how horrible her sister was because my mom had like never gotten over that. And then she put it on me. So my mom would always take my side because she just would see my sister through the lens of like the firstborn mean daughter, right?
Oh God, that's so awful. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's just, it's what happened. My dad was basically an only child in many ways because his brother was born 8 years before him. So he didn't really grow up with that dynamic. So my dad never really projected that kind of stuff on us. But anyways, I want to go into different ways that you might inadvertently be putting your child, a role on your child, and then like how not to do it. So she gives the example of like these two major guidelines in the family is there will be no bullies, there will be no victims. Okay. So let's say you're in a situation where the child says, get out of my room or I'll punch you. Instead of saying, Mike, you're being a bully, you help him see that he's capable of being civil. You say, there's no punching in this house. You need to show us what you need without using physical force. Okay. Another example, one sibling's treating the other child badly and the child says, Daddy, he said he'd kick me if we didn't let him play. He's mean. And instead of saying he's mean, you would say he knows how to be nice too and ask for what he wants in a friendly way. So you say to the sibling, I know you know how to ask in a nice way. Like you kind of empower them to do the right thing versus calling them mean or a bully. And then in terms of victimhood, the parent should not treat one child as a victim. For example, Dad, Mike said I have to share my new yo-yo. And you say, oh, poor baby, your brother's being mean again. So you're like making them the victim. You say, you know, you can tell your brother that this is your yo-yo. It's mine. And I get to decide if I share it. So you want to empower the child not to be the victim. So another example is, let's say some of the children are ganging up about against another sibling to con them in some way. You would just say, save your breath. Your sister is far too smart to be conned. You know, like you want to just keep empowering the victim, the quote unquote victim. I'm trying to think about in my home, like what roles I've put on my children. What about you?
I think probably the roles that I put on my kids are, I think largely around them, what I've been saying in the sense of like, I think one of the things I always say to my daughter, who's the eldest, is I say, you're not the parent. Is it a role to be an anti-role?
Yeah, I've done that too. And that's, you're putting them in the role of being, that they're being too responsible.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest one. And one of the things that I did was detrimental. It was really good for my understanding of my kids, but you know, I love human design and my son's a manifestor. My daughter's a generator. And my, the mistake that we made a long time ago was we would talk about my son being a manifestor versus my daughter being a generator. And that was really detrimental because at one point my daughter heard that and was like, well, my brother's a manifestor, so I can't do anything. And I was like, oh crap. Like I literally have done this thing, which could be incredibly beneficial for them. And now it is detrimental. So we had to work really, really hard to undo that and to just make it intrinsic how we treated them as opposed to ever actually telling them out loud how things are, right? Because it's really hard because my son, as a manifestor, his strategy is to inform and initiate, which means that he's supposed to just tell me what he wants to do. Whereas my daughter, her job is just to respond. Like it's a very, very different thing. So if I pull in this thing, I can uniquely treat them in wonderful ways, but it can feel really unfair on the outside to just have one of the kids not actually have to ask if they can do something and just like let you know that they're going to do something, right? Like that can be, that could feel really bad. And so we've had to backpedal a lot in terms of, and be exceptionally careful about those roles.
Totally get that. Like some of the roles we put on our kids in my home is astrology. You know, we have an Aquarius daughter, a Scorpio child, an Aries son. And so we sometimes joke about each other's behavior based on their astrology. And it's so useful because it's so helpful, but it also, I've realized, is putting them in a role. And so I'm going to stop doing that. Like I'm making a conscious effort not to do it. And then we also have this role in my family that my middle child is the most adventurous eater. They eat everything, oysters, you name it, eel, like whatever. And then my son, my baby, is quote unquote the picky eater, right? That's a role I've created. And then after this book, I decided to change it. So yesterday I went to the grocery store and I said to him, I want you to write me a list of the snacks you want me to get. And they were all kind of like junk food. It was like Doritos, Walker's cookies, and cream cheese and chives crackers. Okay. So when I get home, I thought about it while I was gone. I was like, I really don't want him eating all this junk. So I come home and instead of doing what I would normally do, which is be like, you're so picky, you need to eat healthier. Instead, I came home and I gave him the snacks and I said, I got everything on your list. And I know you have it in you to make better decisions. So next time I go to the store, I want you to make me a list of healthy snacks also. Okay. So I'm taking that role of like, you're the picky eater. You're bad at this, to empowerment and saying you are capable of making better choices. I want you to make some better choices next time. You can do it. Right.
What would you do if they said, no, I can't?
He wouldn't. Trust me.
Mine would. Mine would totally be like, no, I can't.
Oh, he looked at me and he was like, mm-hmm, yeah, I can do that. Because I don't know. He just responded to it really well. Have you tried saying I know you can? Not in a condescending way, but like
absolutely. Absolutely. I have a mismatched child. I have the child who, if you tell them to do it, that's the rock thing. Like if you tell them they can do it, they'll be like, no, I can't. Right. And it doesn't matter how much we at this point, what I've actually my new parenting thing, and this is my husband's on board with this, is trying to kind of, and I'm learning it, is intrinsic motivation in the sense, but intrinsic motivation through not actually verbally asking for anything, but just kind of letting them do it as opposed to having a conversation about it, because both of my kids struggle with the verbal aspect of being told how to do something as opposed to just let's start doing it and then you do it together, or you start them. Like the other day I just handed my son a bag and he like put it in the trash can. Like he didn't even question it. I didn't say anything. It was just like this nonverbal cue and he got it. And that's the type of parenting I have right now, because if we talk and same with, oh my God, like my son, if I ask him what he wants for breakfast, he will never say yes to anything other than waffles, right? Like homemade waffles, right? But if I just hand him food, he eats it. It's like this weird thing that's going on in my family. I don't understand it, but the verbal thing is just like a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. But I do know that in my family, I think it's going to work at least
I'm complicating every single one of these. Sorry. Sorry,
no,
listeners.
No, it's okay. No, it's okay, because everything's different. But I mean, you know what I should do is I should just ask him right now what snacks he wants me to get when I go back to the store and see if it worked. Why don't we try it? Okay. I'm going to go to the grocery store after this and pick up 3 new snacks. What should I get?
The Doritos.
The Doritos?
The chives.
The chive crackers, yeah.
And Walkers.
Walkers, okay. And then remember I said I wanted you to pick out healthier snacks. Do you have any ideas for that?
Celery.
Anything else?
Apples.
Okay. Great job.
I love that. I love how he was like completely, he was so contemplative about that.
All right. We're on to number 5. Okay, here we go. Fighting. Okay. I'm saving the best for last. We're now addressing fighting and consequences.
Yes. Okay.
Now we're going to talk about arguments, which is great. And I love this part of the book because it's going to be so useful. So, okay. She addresses bickering as having 4 different stages. Okay. Number 1 is normal bickering. Number 2 is the situation is heating up and adult intervention might be helpful. Number 3 is the situation is possibly dangerous, like they're already fighting or, you know, whacking each other. And number 4 is the situation is definitely dangerous. Adult intervention is necessary. Okay. So the first thing you need to do is when they're arguing, bickering, whatever, is recognize what level it's at. Like in my family, it's mostly normal bickering. When I am honest about it, it rarely gets to a 2. I know some families have 3s constantly, right? But basically, again, level 1, normal bickering, 2, situations heating up, 3, situations getting dangerous, number 4, it's definitely dangerous. Okay.
Okay.
When there's normal bickering, what to do? Ignore it. Think about your next vacation. Tell yourself that the children are having an important experience in conflict resolution. Don't worry about it. Don't get involved. Okay. There's that. During stage two, when the situation is heating up and adult intervention might be helpful, these are the steps to take. Number one, acknowledge their anger. Two, reflect each child's point of view. Three, describe the problem with respect. Number four, express confidence in the children's ability to find their own solution and leave the room. Okay, so in this example, the children are fighting over who gets to hold the new puppy, okay? So here's an example. You two sound so mad at each other. Sarah, you want to keep on holding the puppy because he's just settled down in your arms and falling asleep. And Billy, you feel you're entitled to a turn too because you've been waiting. It's a tough one. There's two children and only one puppy. I have confidence that you two can work out a solution that's fair to each of you and fair to the puppy. Okay? So you keep empowering them. I know you have it in you to find a solution that is that will work. And what's beautiful is I have done that a lot in the past without reading the book, is I'd say, well, what do you guys think the solution is? And I wouldn't leave the room, like she says, and let them figure it out. I like watch them talk it out. And the kids will come up with brilliant solutions. Like, you'd be so surprised. Like, I remember one time my kids were, you know, bickering about something. And I said, well, what is the solution you both would agree on that you think is fair? And the solution was that my son was going to give my other child the brownie, but then she was going to do his chores for him or something, you know, like they brought chores into it or something that I never would have thought. Okay. In stage three, when the situation is possibly dangerous and the kids are actually about to hit each other or hurting each other, you inquire, you let the children know what is and isn't acceptable behavior in the family, and you respect the feelings. So you would say, for example, let's say the kids are arguing. Is this a play fight or a real fight? Play fights are permitted, but real fights are not permitted. Play fighting is by mutual consent only. And if it's not fun for both of you, it has to stop. You may be playing, but it's too rough for me. You need to find another activity. So you step in that situation, right? And then she also talks, this isn't in this section, but she talks about property rights and how, and sharing, and how you want to encourage sharing. And she says that the property rights belong to the owner of the property. So the example given was like the younger sister really wanted to borrow the older sister's blouse, and the older sister had grown out of it, so she had no use for it anymore. But it was also the older daughter's favorite blouse. So the younger daughter was saying, well, she doesn't even use it anymore, and I need it for picture day. And, you know, the mother could have gone both ways and said, this is Alice's blouse, and she doesn't have to share it. It's her property. And the second way would have been, Alice, you've grown out of it. It doesn't mean anything to you anyways. I will get you a new blouse. You don't even fit in this anymore. So she could have gone either way, right? But what she did instead was she said, Alice, this is your Alice, you've got a beautiful blouse here. It's very special to you. And your sister really wants to wear it for picture day. However, it's your property. So you get to decide what's right for you. Why don't you guys talk it out and see if you can come up with a solution that works for both of you. But at the end of the day, the blouse does belong to Alice. Mm-hmm. And she gets to decide, you know. So there, she gave property rights a little subset in there. All right. Stage four. The situation is definitely dangerous. Adult intervention is necessary. You describe what you see and you separate the children. Example. I see two very angry children who are about to hurt each other. It's not safe to be together. We must have a cooling off period. Quick to each of your rooms, and then we're going to talk about this when you cool off. When she talks more about this, when the children can't work out a problem by themselves, call a meeting and explain the purpose and the ground rules. You, as the mediator, writes down each of the child's feelings and concerns, and you read them aloud. You allow time for rebuttal. So you get your list, you know, on one side, you got the column of each child. In each column, you have kind of what each child's feelings and concerns are. You invite everybody to come up with solutions, and you write down all ideas without evaluating. The parent just writes it down, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, you write them all down. And then everyone together decides on a solution they can all live with. And then you follow up and see if it works.
Okay.
You state each child's case. You state the value or the rule. You know, in my house, there's no name calling or physical violence. You know, every house is going to have different rules. and you leave the doorway open for the possibility of negotiation. So, Christina, what are some ways that you've resolved arguments that have worked and haven't worked?
The one that my kids don't seem very interested in at all, which is the one that I really love, which is unfortunate, is the one that is like, why don't we sit down and everybody talk? Like, you say how you feel, you say how you feel, right? Like, so it's like a very like kind of like an adult would do in a mediation is like, hey, just everybody say how you feel and let's do it. My kids do not have the patience for that. They think it's such a waste of time, which is really, really hard. And that may be because we're intervening at a level too low, like a level zero or a level one, and it doesn't necessarily need it. My kids like vividly remember the time that they've been grounded, which is associated with certain events. And so I've definitely not done the best idea when it comes to that, is that like, that's where I've struggled with consequences, is that there are some things that I just like have an automatic reaction to. Anything that causes property damage, that was carelessness that causes property damage, and anything that actually causes significant harm to the other kid has usually resulted in grounding of some sort. And I'm just like, and that's been hard because, again, the consequence is, that's what I was talking about in terms of like age appropriate consequence and not being a permissive parent, but being an authoritative parent. Like, I've struggled a little bit with that because I don't know if grounding is actually ever that it, you know, is ever a necessarily a good consequence. Whereas I feel like better consequences, I'm coming to around to the understanding that grounding is just too generic, that actually the real consequence is something that results directly from, like, for instance, if you guys remember the Indomitable Black man that came onto the podcast a couple seasons ago, he talked about how age appropriate consequences are like, hey, if you hit somebody, then you can't watch anything that's violent. Or any, you know, it has to be directly a correlation with what they're doing. Did I actually answer your question?
No, yeah, you did. My question for you is, what if the next time there's a consequence is needed, why don't you not come up with it?
That's what I think needs to happen. And I think that that will feel so much better because that's what I was talking about as the main complaint, is that my son's like, there's no consequence. But I always felt like I was the one who had to come up with the consequence. And I'm like, that's a brilliant idea, is just have him come up with the consequence. Like, you know what I mean? And then see if that's something that's valid, or have her come up with the consequence, or have them negotiate what that consequence feels like it needs to be. Maybe. Yeah. Did I get that right? Did I get it right on the quiz?
So what were you saying?
I was saying that whoever is the one who feels as if they've been wrong creates the consequence. But is that the wrong?
No.
Did I miss that? It's the opposite. The person who did the wrong needs to create the consequence. Neither. They come with up with
no.
it together.
They need to collaborate. They have to collaborate on a consequence that okay. works for both of them.
Okay. I got it.
Because otherwise you're encouraging victimhood.
You're either encouraging victimhood or somebody becomes the judge, jury, and executioner. Because that's, I feel like oftentimes the issue is everybody's questioning the story. Right. And so therefore, either they're trying to get out of it, or they're blatantly like they're doing something that's basically questioning the validity of the other person's argument. Like, that's where we are a lot of times in our arguments with each other. And so doing it together makes sense.
Yeah, that's like the biggest takeaway, is it has to be collaborative. And that's how real life works. Right. I mean, unless you're in the police station, there is never really someone executing a consequence on you, really, you know?
Yes.
Like, even exactly. bosses have to collaborate. Exactly. I will say, when I've done it this way, and I don't always remember to do it, it definitely is very helpful. And it's very cute to see the consequences or whatever that they come up with. So here are other ways to encourage good feelings between brothers and sisters. And I remember my parents were really good about this one, about date nights. Make sure each child gets some time alone with you several times a week. This one-on-one connection provides the emotional nourishment kids need to be more caring, or at the very least, more tolerant of their siblings. Once you set the time aside, honor it. Don't let a phone call break the mood, and don't talk about the other child, because then they're going to say, well, gosh, they hog all your attention even when you're with me. If someone calls you, you could say something like, hey, can I call you back right now? Can I call you back right now? I'm talking to right now. Christina and I are spending time together. And that will help them understand that their time is important and have a greater sense of their own value. Don't lock children in their position in their family constellation, like oldest, youngest, or middle. Allow each child the opportunity to experience some of the privileges and responsibilities of the other. Part of what creates deep resentment between siblings is the demand by parents that they always maintain their family position. And I need to talk to my husband about this because he'll often say, well, you're the older one. You need to set a good example. And like, that's not good. That can breed resentment. Don't get trapped by togetherness. This is for me. Don't force kids together if there is irritation between them. Don't force them to always get along. It could drive them further apart. Give everyone more breathing space when this happens with different adult and child combinations. So, you know, daddy-daughter date, father-son date, whatever. Let each child know what it is about him that his siblings like or admire. Just knowing that your sibling might like you or talk nicely about you when you're not around can have a dramatic shift in a relationship. And finally, I don't do this, but I know you do, schedule family meetings. You wouldn't expect your car to run without periodic refueling and maintenance. And I like that idea. My parents did do family meetings when I think about it, but like not consistently. But I kind of think like maybe the first, you know, the first whatever of a month, maybe we'll just do a check-in and just talk about what everyone's up to and what the rules are or whatever. I don't know.
It's very different in my family because of the fact that we're all 24/7 together a lot, right? So because of that, like a lot of the decision things are, these are the activities that are happening for school this week, like for homeschool this week. These are like, so for us, it's like very intrinsic in what we do because we all have different projects going on all the time. Like our life is exceeds like maintenance, like probably way too much, right? In the sense of like, oh, guess what? I have a project that I need to do where I need to like, you know, I'm going to build a chicken coop or whatever, right? And so then everybody needs to understand, I want to build a chicken coop, but I have 10 bazillion other projects in front of that. But, you know, or we're going to be working on this. And so, and then the kids, you know, we're incorporating reports and all these different things. So everything kind of becomes a family affair. And that's why we do meetings as opposed to like, whereas if your life is like relatively the same and doesn't have a lot of very different things, my kids also like to know about things in advance. It helps them a lot to regulate.
And then do you have family meetings on the calendar or like you just randomly have them? Or
we try and do it once a week. We try and do it once a week. We have a family game night and we have a movie night, a family movie night. And so we try and do the meeting around that, but it's been inconsistent. It's pretty hard to do in the summer because everything's so crazy with schedules. And since going away, and it's been a bit of a crazy like 8 weeks. But yeah, that's the idea, is that like we do all the family stuff kind of in one big chunk on the day. And then that's good because then people know what's going to happen that week.
Very cool. So yeah. Okay. So for me going forward, I want to like say what I've gotten out of this book, what I want to implement in the future. Cause I feel like if I say it, I'll do it more. I want to be more conscious about those roles, no roles. I want to do the family meeting and I want to be more attentive to whether or not it's bickering or a level two. Cause if it's just level one, I need to just stay the fuck out of it. And then level two is when I'll get involved. Yeah. What about you?
All right. So a couple of things. I mean, there's so much. I love the idea of the kids coming up with the consequences together. I love the idea of them collaborating for whatever that looks like in terms of, I just, that's like one of my favorite things with the consequences is like, actually, I don't need to come up with consequences, right? At all, especially because I just really enjoy that part. One of the other ones I would definitely say is how to uniquely treat them, how to treat them uniquely, right? Of how can I encourage that more and how can I play to their different strengths while also trying to help them move past their challenges, but uniquely do that. We also need to do better at spending time individually with each kid. That's something that I'm trying to pull more into my schedule of like, actually spending time, either if it's on schoolwork or we're going somewhere. There's a lot of limited options where I live, but like we have to keep evolving what we do with them individually.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I got this from you. It's school's almost starting again. We have to get school supplies. And you told me the story how you have a friend with four kids and how she took each child to Target by themselves for their school supplies. And I was like, why would she do that? It's such a bad use of time. And you were like, but then she gets to spend one-on-one with each child and like know their hopes and wishes for the school year and all that. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually really good. So I'm going to be doing that this week, taking each child to school, to the
That's
store by
awesome.
themselves, get supplies. I did it last year too, and I really actually liked it.
Yeah.
It's nice to be able to like really hone in on that. Another thing I just want to bring up about this episode is it might bring up things in your own childhood. And it might encourage you to reach out to a sibling and say, hey, I realize now on reflection that like mom and dad put me in this role and I'm really sorry for my hand in that and whatever. Like one of the things that the therapist talked about that in that parent meeting that she put on, the parent workshop that she put on is that the people were there to learn how to be better parents to their children. But in doing so, they really healed a lot of their relationships with their siblings by recognizing how their childhood affected their relationships. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's a really fascinating thing. I'm sure we could probably scrounge up a lot on the sibling wounds, right? Especially, yeah, I especially when it comes to aging and elderly parents, I feel like there's a lot going on in those dynamics as people get older. Though, if you're interested in hearing something like that, maybe we can put together an episode. So just drop us an email at this.spiritual.fix@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, y'all. Thanks, Anna.
Bye.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode of This Spiritual Fix. We wanted to encourage you to spread the word of our podcast and that we're back to any friends or family who may have listened to it before. We'd really appreciate the boost.
And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Hello, TSF family. I wanted to offer an exclusive invitation to listeners of the podcast for a retreat that I am hosting in Italy, in Labro, an hour outside of Rome, on Enterogetics. Enterogetics allows us to pull into our body and understand how to create a bulletproof energy field. It's one of the many things that I practice with my clients, and I am so excited to be able to incorporate this very interesting energetic place of Labro with the exclusiveness of a completely restorative retreat that is filled with community, camaraderie, and most of all, connection with our most divine selves. I hope that you'll join me. If you come to www.christinawiltsy.com, you can get more information or reach out at chris@chriswiltsy.com. I hope to see you there. And if you book before August 15th, you'll get an exclusive early bird discount. Thanks, y'all.